questions on it, right? They're all A stars. Two main sequence stars, Altair and Vega. Deneb's a supergiant star. Going. So that whole list of stars that we've gone over, those are fair game for the exam. Certainly one way they'll be tested is probably, well, I won't say certainly. I guess I've never not done it. It would be the winter hexagon, but should be able to identify all of those stars, I don't know, 15 stars, something like that, that whose spectral types you're supposed to know. So we started last time by thinking about this kind of problem. It turns out, and we'll, requires a little bit of explanation, but it turns out we think that post-Big Bang, right, so 3 minutes after the Big Bang, we think all you had was hydrogen and helium. So everything else, which is mostly what you're made out of, right, calcium, iron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, all of that stuff had to be created by thermonuclear reactions in the core of stars, and then somehow or other spat out back to the interstellar medium so that when new stars formed, they would have a little bit of the else. So one kind of confusing term, I've used the term else pretty consistently because I think it's a pretty good word. The usual word is metals. So to an astronomer, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, those are all metals. Anything that's not hydrogen or helium counts as a metal. So the book will talk about metal content of stars. The largest contributors to metals are going to be carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. Those are the kind of the third, fourth, and fifth most common elements in the universe. So the way we can reuse material is by, in the case of low mass stars, they form planetary nebulae, so they're going to puff off, 40% of their mass, depends on the particular star, and that material is going to go back into the interstellar media. It turns out that for more massive stars, and here we're thinking about stars that weigh 10 or 100 times the mass of the sun, they're going to end up with objects that are just a few times the mass of the sun. So a very large fraction of the mass of the massive star gets blown off, typically in the form of an explosion like a supernova, and that material is returned to the interstellar media. So practically, we find lots of recent stars like the sun that have a few percent of else. If we look hard, we find stars that have a lot less, like a hundredth the amount of the sun. Those we call population 2 stars. Theoretically, the first generation of stars would have zero else, right? They would be just hydrogen and helium. As you might imagine, it's kind of hard to find those stars 13.7 billion years after that all started. But people are actively looking for population 3 stars. And we have found population 3 gas just recently in the last couple of months. So population 3 stars are probably be discovered, I would think, in the next 5 years if we continue to look hard for them. So bringing up the idea of carbon stars, these are stars in which processed material has been dredged up, carbon, from the core. And so the stuff that's coming off of these stars is very sooty. These stars are, generally speaking, asymptotic giant stars, so they're very bright and very cold, and not particularly uncommon. They tend to kind of blow off gas episodically, every 3 months, every year, what's considered a relatively long-term time, and then they increase in brightness tremendously, change color a little bit. So these are called long-term variables. And carbon stars are an example of long-term variables. Cepheids are, I don't know if I'd say more or less common, a more important class, I guess, of stars. So these stars are stars that have kind of A and F spectral type. So they're generally speaking hotter than their sun. They're giant stars. They go through a cycle where they get bright and dim. Commonly, it's in days, but it can be a couple of months. And if we look at the time it takes to go through a cycle, it turns out there's a relationship between that time and the corresponding absolute magnitude, luminosity. And of course, if we measure the apparent brightness and we know the absolute magnitude, we can calculate the distance modulus and we can get the distance. So Cepheid variable stars are important as a way of getting distances beyond parallax. Turns out there's a complication that Cepheid variables that are as metal-rich as the sun is have a slightly different period luminosity relationship compared to stars that are metal-poor. So the exact relationship between period and absolute magnitude depends whether you're a population 1 or a population 2 star. And it turns out that the Cepheid variable I study is a type 2 Cepheid. There are also stars that are, we'll talk more about them, so this won't be on the exam, we'll talk more about them in the future, are our Leary stars, which are essentially short period Cepheid variable stars. And they're found in globular clusters, and they're important to get the distance to globular clusters. But although we've run into globular clusters in lab, we haven't really talked about them in detail. So another way we can have variable stars is by having novas, which are essentially exploding stars. So kind of the setup for this is we can have two different, most stars are actually born in pairs or triplets. Our sun is a little bit unusual, being a solitary star. And the most massive of the pair, of course, is going to evolve first into a giant star. And if they're close enough, when it expands, it'll fill its Roche lobe and material will be dumped on the lower mass star. If this lower mass star turns out to be a white dwarf, and it particularly might be in the future, then we're going to have an accumulation of unburned hydrogen material on the degenerate surface of a very hot object. And as that stuff accumulates, it can explode. Degenerate gases can explode. And so we get a sudden brightening of this object, and then over a month or so, it'll dim down again. So these are reoccurring processes. Nothing is destroyed in this process. The binary remains intact. And we see these things repeating on time scales of a few decades. They're very quick novas that repeat on a time scale of maybe 1 year, but more commonly decades and probably centuries. Then we can have actually exploding stars. So supernova stars are stars where we have total disruption. And we talked last time mostly about the type 1A supernovas. Type 1A supernovas are this sort of situation where we keep adding more and more mass onto a white dwarf. And, you know, kind of jumping ahead a little bit, it turns out that there's a upper mass limit for a white dwarf, 1.4 times the mass of the sun, which was discovered by a guy called Chandrasekhar. So it's called the Chandrasekhar mass limit. And if we go over that limit, then we start to have compression, which leads to detonation of the carbon oxygen. So it's a thermonuclear reaction. The white dwarf is, of course, degenerate, so it's not going to be a controlled reaction. It's going to be an explosion. And that's what a type 1A supernova is. I think I didn't do much more than mention type 2 supernovas, but the story is similar but different. So here we have a solitary star. We go to this kind of onion-shaped star. We can't burn the iron. We have degenerate gas here. This goes over the Chandrasekhar mass limit, and it implodes. So this isn't an explosion. There's no thermonuclear release of energy. This is gravitational energy that's been released. And enough gravitational energy is released that the bulk of the star is going to be thrown out at high speeds. Okay, so kind of the book's take on this all is this sort of story. So if we have a very low mass object like a planet Jupiter, it's degenerate. It never gets hot enough to cook hydrogen to helium, so it's going to last apparently forever. If we have objects that are like a hundredth of the mass of the sun, then that's still not going to get hot enough to burn hydrogen to helium, but it's big enough that we call it a brown dwarf star. It will briefly be hot just because it has collapsed. And so we can see brown dwarfs as incandescent objects, but they're not actually going to return hydrogen to helium. And they have, again, essentially also infinite lifetime. So about the lowest mass stars that actually burn hydrogen to helium are about a tenth the mass of the sun. These things are all born in giant molecular clouds, so it's kind of hard to see what's going on. We have a low mass star, which is a type M star, and none of these things have died yet. Just because they have long lifetimes, they're going to end up as white dwarfs without ever having gone through a giant stage. And what's going on, if you remember this picture, is that these stars are convective throughout. So we're not going to have a buildup of shells, and it's the buildup of shells that lead to the giant behavior. So they just, over the eons, they gradually cook themselves from 75% hydrogen to 0% hydrogen and 100% helium, and they become a white dwarf. So here's a star like the Sun, main sequence, 10 billion year lifetime, so that's less than the lifetime of the universe, puff out their outer layers, become variable stars, and end up as white dwarfs. Okay, so more massive stars have a very short lifetime. They also go through these giant stages, and they can end up with core collapse into what we're going to be talking about mostly today, neutron stars, or if we're talking about even more massive stars, into black holes. So overall, the more massive stars have substantially less lifetime, as we've talked about lots of times. Okay. So we've got these three ways that a star can die. Well, maybe four ways that a star can die. It can totally disrupt, so there's nothing left. But if there is something left, it better be a degenerate gas, or in the case of a black hole, something special. The white dwarfs are stars that typically would have a mass of, say, 0.4 times the mass of the Sun. They would be smaller if the starting star was smaller. They're supported by degenerate electron gas. And they have this kind of odd property where if you add mass to them, they actually would have a smaller radius. And what's going on then is if we add more and more mass, the radius is going to approach zero, which means that the electrons have to be going faster and faster and faster to support it, but they can only go so fast. They can only go as fast as the speed of light. So as a result, there is this upper limit to the mass of a white dwarf that's the Chandrasekhar mass limit. And this story is true for any degenerate object. So for neutron stars, it's going to be repeated, except there we have degenerate neutrons being the gas that's supporting the object. But if we add mass to a neutron star, the neutrons can only go so fast, and there'll be an upper limit to the neutron star's mass. Chandrasekhar could very accurately calculate his mass limit because the electrons basically don't feel the strong nuclear force, so things are fairly simple. In the case of a neutron star, it's a much harder problem to calculate because not only are there the electric forces, there are also nuclear forces that are holding it together. You can think about a neutron star as just kind of a big nucleus. So we don't actually have an accurate value for the mass for the biggest possible mass of a neutron star. People speculate 2 to 3 times the mass of the Sun. The most massive neutron star that has been measured is about twice the mass of the Sun, but we haven't measured the mass of very many neutron stars, right? In order to measure mass, it takes a pretty special circumstance, which we'll be talking about today. So overall, white dwarfs are about the size of the Earth, which is about 1/100 the size of the Sun, so we're talking about very small objects. Neutron stars are substantially smaller than that, having a radius of, say, 10 kilometers. Both of these things would have roughly the mass of the Sun in them, so we have hugely dense material in the case of a neutron star. So what's happening should seem a little bit strange, because if you had a bottle full of neutrons, the neutrons would spontaneously decay into protons and positrons and neutrinos. But the opposite reaction is also possible if the electrons are high energy. So if we have real high energy electrons, they can combine to protons to make a more massive object like a neutron, and in the process release neutrinos. So anytime we have the production of of something like a neutron star, we expect that there's going to be a lot of neutrinos released. And we'll talk more about that, I hope, today. Black holes, in theory, the size is actually zero. There's everything is crushed to a mathematical point. But when people talk about the size of a black hole, they're usually talking about the size of the so-called Schwarzschild radius. Schwarzschild is a dead German at the front of World War I. He named this guy shortly after Einstein wrote down the theory of general relativity. And that's the closest, that's as close as you can get to a neutron star and come back. So light can't escape from inside the Schwarzschild radius. The escape velocity would be, in some sense, more than the speed of light. So the actual size of the Schwarzschild radius depends on the mass of the central object. For something the mass of the sun, it would be, say, 3 kilometers. So a solar mass-sized black hole isn't hugely smaller than a neutron star. A neutron star is kind of on the verge of becoming a black hole. And we also talked about earlier, and I had to fit it onto this board someplace, the Algol paradox, which is how we introduced this idea of Roche lobes. And that's the odd situation with Algol, where we have a main sequence B star that is more massive than the evolved K star as a binary combination. So the evolved K star, well, we know that the high mass thing evolves first, so you would have guessed that the B star would evolve before the K star, but that's not the case. And what happens, if I have this thing correctly oriented, is what was originally the high mass object, because of mass transfer, becomes the low mass object. And the previously low mass object becomes the high mass object. So currently we would have, in Algol's case, something like this, where we have an evolved K star that was more massive, and we have a main sequence B star that is now the most massive partner in it. So this Algol situation is not at all uncommon in terms of close binary stars. Questions? So you know from the reading that the plan today is to talk more about neutron stars and black holes. So it turns out that neutron stars were talked about theoretically soon after neutrons were discovered. So I think neutrons were discovered in 1932, and the first paper on neutron stars was 1934. But people really never suspected that they were going to discover these things, because they have such incredibly small size. And so if they're that small, even if they're very hot, you're never going to be able to see them if they're 10 light years away. So people mostly were thinking about neutron stars in terms of speculative possibilities. But in fact, these things were discovered in about 1967 by Joycelyn Bell, who did not get the Nobel Prize for the discovery. So it's one of these kind of funny, unhappy stories in the history of science. So Joycelyn Bell's boss was Anthony Huish, and he's the guy who got the funding for kind of a specially designed radio telescope. And his idea was that you know how stars twinkle because of the Earth's atmosphere. Generally speaking, radio light doesn't interact with the Earth's atmosphere, so we don't expect radio sources to be twinkling. But remember that there's all of this stuff, all of this gas in space that's between us and distant objects. That could cause twinkling of radio sources. So on a huge scale, the plasma that fills space should also have turbulence in it and should have kind of a repetition of what we see with optical light. Okay, so the universe is pretty transparent. Plasmas are pretty transparent to visible light, so we don't have this phenomenon with visible light, but we have it with the Earth's atmosphere. Radio is, our atmosphere is transparent to radio light, but this same sort of phenomena might be present in radio sources. So that was the idea. So unlike other people, he made a radio telescope that was designed to look for short-range phenomena. So usually in astronomy, we're taking very long exposures because we're looking at dim objects, and so we've automatically averaged over anything that is short time scale. But he was looking for something that was short time scale. And you know, as often is the case, the boss doesn't do the work, right? The graduate students do the work. So Joycelyn Bell was doing the work. And not uncommonly, under these sort of situations, it kind of makes sense for the boss to get the Nobel Prize in the end, because essentially he's using the hands of the graduate student. He's thought of the idea, he's got the equipment funded, he built the equipment, and then he said, go do X, Y, and Z. And so you don't feel so bad about it in those sorts of circumstances when the boss gets the prize. But that's not what happened here. So in this case here, something totally unexpected was discovered, and Jocelyn Bell found these very regular pulses. So if it's something like the scintillation of starlight, it would be random, right? Bright, dim, bright, 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 dim. You know, we're not expecting any definite pattern to scintillation. But these were brightenings that were precise, more precise than any available clock. So this was a puzzle. And what happened is Bell brought this discovery to Huish, and Huish dismissed it. He said, something like that has to be man-made. So therefore, don't waste your time studying it. Study this other stuff that I'm interested. But Jocelyn Bell pursued it, and in the end, in a sense we'll talk about, these are the start of what are called pulsars. So these are radio sources that blink on, blink off, on a time scale that is typically measured in seconds, but it might be as short as a thousandth of a second, which is called a millisecond. And I know Huish wasn't crazy, right? It's very hard to understand how anything astronomical could be happening at that sort of time scale. So people looked around for explanations, and for a while these things were called, were thought to be the result of little green men. So they had the abbreviation LGMs. But the explanation turns out to be something that's a little bit simpler than you might expect. So you remember that the sun, yep. Not correctly.
Okay.
It's thousandths of a second.
Okay. I mean, it makes more sense as thousandths. But
yep. Okay. So we try, in the metric system these days, we try and divide things up by powers of a thousand. So we have thousands, millions, billions, etc. There's one kind of important exception. There's another important exception, I guess, too. And that's centimeters. So centimeters are the one common thing that is a hundredth of something. And I'm sure centimeters were invented just because a meter is kind of too big for construction work, and a millimeter is kind of too small for construction work. So we had something that's about half an inch. It's convenient for doing construction stuff. And I think they consider it kind of a mistake. So these days, very commonly, we're measuring things in terms of millimeters instead. The other exception that you see occasionally has to do with areas, right? So we measure areas in this country in terms of acres of land. And in terms of square meters, it's not very convenient. And square kilometers are kind of too big for a typical farm. So hectares is a combination of 100 square meters that's not uncommonly used. But otherwise, pretty much everything is factors of 1,000.
Yeah, but like on stopwatches, they'll have, I guess...
Milliseconds are thousandths of a second, always. So if somebody tells you that you had a 100-meter dash time of something like that, and they say that you were a millisecond above 10 seconds, that's wrong, right? You're 10 milliseconds above... Well, it's hard to think of astronomical phenomena that occur in this sort of time frame. So I think probably the fastest thing we've talked about is the rotation of the Earth, right, which is once a day. So what could possibly be going on in terms of those sort of very short times? So if you're thinking about something that is a millisecond, you know, that's something that is happening faster than, for example, the crankshaft is rotating in your car engine. So really fast stuff. And the answer to what's going on here, what people needed to remember, is our ice skater. So if we start with something big, like the sun, that is just rotating once a month, and we collapse it to something that is just 10 kilometers in size, it's going to automatically be spinning hugely fast just by conservation of angular momentum. So we can get these sort of very fast rotation rates just by collapse of something that is spinning at a moderate rate. So a collapse of a star would generate that thing pretty nicely. And one of the things that is kind of automatically happens with things that are rotating is they're going to be very, very, very regular, right? It'd be hard to think of something more regular than the rotation of the Earth. But if you look in detail, you know that the rotation of the Earth is gradually slowing down, basically because of tidal forces. And if we look in great detail at the pulsars, we find that they're also slowing down. So this rotation rate is very gradually going slower and slower and slower, except occasionally it'll suddenly speed up or suddenly speed down, more commonly speed up, and this is called a glitch. And we think what's going on here is basically a star quake. So there's essentially a crust to this neutron star. If it breaks, we're going to have a collapse to something that's a little bit smaller. When it gets a little bit smaller, it's going to speed up. If we have something that is slowing down, then that energy has to go someplace. In the case of the Earth, the slowing down of the Earth's rotation rate is part and parcel of moving the moon out. But we know that certainly the pulsars that were first being detected are not parts of binary systems, although in a second I'll say that binary pulsars are super interesting and super useful in order to study. And kind of a big hint as to what was going on here is one of the first pulsars that was actually... So radio telescopes, you remember, are, particularly in 1967, have really poor angular resolution. So you remember that in order to get good angular resolution for a radio telescope, you need a radio interferometer, where you have lots of radio telescopes acting together. And that's not what Hewish had. He had a single disc radio antenna. So, you know, they knew that these pulses were coming from, you know, roughly speaking, there in the sky. But precisely where in the sky was up for grabs. So when they pinned down where these things were located, one of the first ones that was noticed was in the Crab Nebula. And we know historically that the source of the Crab Nebula is an exploding star. The Chinese report what they call the guest star, a new star, in the constellation Taurus, right where the Crab Nebula is today. I don't think I have the exact date right, but roughly 1000 AD is when the Chinese noticed this bright star that occurred in the sky for on the order of a year and then dimmed out. So the Crab Nebula is an example of the remains of an exploding star. So these things are called supernova remnants. And the Crab Nebula itself isn't particularly bright, but it's pretty big. And if you add up all of the energy that's being given off by the Crab Nebula, it was hard in 1967 to figure out what was powering it. It had lasted for 1,000 years, so it wasn't just leftover energy. It had to be some continuous source of it. And the answer is that the Crab Nebula is being powered by the spinning down, by the slowing down of the pulsar that lies at the center of the Crab Nebula. So how does all of this happen? How does a fast spinning object get connected to this rarefied gas that's, you know, a light year from that spinning pulsar? And the answer has to do with another conservation law. So we talked about conservation of angular momentum. Right, that's what was responsible for the ice skater effect. So we had something that was, this was, remember, roughly the rate of RPMs. So if we make this a lot smaller, we have to make the rate of RPMs a lot faster. And it turns out there's another conservation law. It's only an approximate conservation law, but it's good for conducting materials, and that has to do with magnetic flux. So it turns out if you take the radius squared of an object times the strength of the magnetic field, that also has to be approximately a constant. So the sun has a magnetic field that's quite noticeably stronger than the Earth's magnetic field, but it's, you know, it's not super strong. It's not as strong as a bar magnet, for example. But the same phenomena will occur if we make the radius of a star hugely smaller. The magnetic field is going to have to grow to colossal quantities. So automatically, if you take something like the sun that has a moderate magnetic field and is spinning slowly, and you collapse it, you're automatically going to get something that is spinning hugely fast and has a huge magnetic field. So now we have something that has a huge magnetic field and is rotating. That's exactly what we would need to produce radio light. A changing magnetic field or electric field is all that you need to produce light. But that's kind of only the start of the situation. So you remember we were talking about microwaves. The way microwaves worked is we had a magnetic field, and we had electrons that were spiraling in that magnetic field to make the microwave light. So now we've got a tremendously big magnetic field, and we're going to have high-speed electrons, so we can have exactly the same sort of phenomena making synchrotron light. Now, kind of the amazing thing is, when your microwave goes on, it's not bright, right? It's not producing visible light. It's producing light of a wavelength that's about a millimeter or so. But the magnetic fields are so strong that the synchrotron light that is being produced is actually visible light. So we're producing all the colors of light by this process that on Earth, at least, with normal-sized magnetic fields only makes radio-sized light. The frequencies that are being produced have been shifted all the way up into the visible. Well, I hope I've convinced you so far that a rotating magnetic field has the possibilities of making lots of types of light. But what's the pulses? Obviously, the pulses have to be tied to rotation. So we're thinking about something that's kind of like a lighthouse. So the idea is we have a spinning magnetic, a spinning pulsar, which is producing beams of radio light that are pointing in different directions as the pulsar spins around. And if those beams of radio light happen to be pointed towards the Earth, we're going to see a pulsar. If they're not, we're not going to see that pulsar, at least not as a pulsing radio source. Okay, so Joycelyn Bell discovered these things as very puzzling pulsing radio sources that had a frequency that was not what you would connect usually to astronomical objects. Over time, it was realized that the power source for this thing was a rotating neutron star. The reason it was rotating fast is because it had collapsed. It's in the process of slowing down. And the loss of energy is what's powering the nebula that surrounds the pulsar, which is in one famous case, the Crab Nebula. And we know that the Crab Nebula was formed by a supernova, so things are nicely tied together. Questions on any of that? So once over time, the pulsar is going to slow down enough that it's not rotating fast, and then this whole process should basically at that point go dark because there isn't anything around to produce any sorts of energy. But if we have a binary companion to a neutron star, then we can have, this particular setup is for a black hole, But the same thing applies to one of these ways it's got, oh, this was right. So here in this particular case, we have a black hole being imagined as part of a binary companion. But the same thing would apply if this were any very small collapsed object, including a neutron star. When material gets dumped on that from a companion, we can have X-ray production. And we can also have an exact restatement of the nova phenomena. So remember what happened in novas is we had hydrogen material that was being dumped on a white dwarf, and when it built up into a layer that was thick enough, it would explode on the surface to produce a sudden brightening. So we have that same repetition of that process that can occur with neutron stars that are part of a binary companion. Except it turns out that in the case of neutron stars, their surfaces are so hot that the hydrogen burns before it can build up to any particular thickness. So it's actually helium that is exploding in the case of the analogous phenomena on a neutron star. Well, this is, certainly I believe this when I first heard it, but it is a whole lot of speculation. And it would be nice to have increasingly direct measurements of all of this stuff, so you could be sure that this is pretty much what's going on. There's a perfect match, basically, between the energy that we see lost because of the slowing down of the pulsar that's in the center of the Crab Nebula and the energy we see leaving the Crab Nebula. And we can understand why something would be spinning fast if it were a collapsed object. And we see both relatively fast spinning. So it turns out that the Crab Nebula was one of the faster of the pulsars that when it was discovered. It goes through about 30 revolutions per second. Whereas kind of more typically, pulsars have a repetition rate of 1 second. And that kind of makes sense. This was the freshest supernova that we had around, so it has the fastest speed of any pulsar that we have around. I put a little asterisk and say, I'm soon going to talk about things that are rotating a lot faster than the Crab is, but it'll take something extra going on. So considerable light was shed on these neutron stars, and everyone became a believer, I think, at this point, when binary pulsars were discovered. So in a binary pulsar, I'm talking about two neutron stars that are orbiting around each other. With nothing else particularly in the vicinity. Well, what's special about this situation? Well, remember that if we have binary stars, we have the possibility of measuring the mass. And what was discovered is that the mass of each one of these pulsars is pretty accurately 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. And that's a nice match to the biggest possible white dwarf. So it makes sense that what we're seeing here are objects that have gone over the Chandrasekhar mass limit and are now much compressed. The other thing you can do with the binary pulsar is because of the very precise timing, and I can't stress that enough, these guys compete now with the best atomic clocks in terms of accurate timing. So we can get extraordinarily good measurements of the Doppler effect of these things. So we have kind of down to centimeter per second sort of accuracy on the speeds of these binary pulsars. There's kind of nothing. When you look at the papers that deal with the binary pulsars, there'll be a string of 9 digits that gives you the parameters to describe this thing. So they're known to exquisite accuracy. And in particular, what is nice about these things is what we see is that there is energy loss. What's happening is these binary pulsars are gradually coming closer and closer and closer together. And people have speculated what could be the cause of this energy loss, apparent energy loss. We know that energy is conserved, so we know that energy has to be going someplace. And the explanation that works is that what's happening is gravitational radiation. So if these were electrically charged particles as opposed to things with mass, if they're orbiting around each other, we think they would make electromagnetic waves, light. So here we have two gravitational objects, two things with mass that are rotating around each other. And according to Einstein, they should be radiating gravitation. So we should have cases of compressed gravity and expanded gravity, basically, propagating out. And that energy loss, turns out, you can calculate it from Einstein's theory, is exactly what's required to explain the very slow inflow of these binary pulsars. So I think I said weeks ago that there's kind of good evidence for gravitational radiation. And this is the evidence I was talking about. It's not direct evidence, right? So all we really know is that there's energy loss, and the rate that the energy is being lost matches what Einstein said should be lost. But you know, maybe something else is going on. So there are ongoing efforts, LIGO is one of them, that are looking to directly detect gravitational radiation. And it takes something a little bit more energetic than the binary pulsar in order to make noticeable amounts of gravitational radiation on Earth. And what they're looking for is kind of the equivalent thing with black holes, and not black holes that are far apart, but black holes that are very close together, so that they have orbital speeds that's measured in milliseconds. So in the last few moments before these black holes collapse onto each other, they should be producing a pulse of gravitational radiation, which there's some hope of detecting. There's nothing really harder to detect than gravitational radiation that I can think of. So to give you kind of a feeling for what's going on, LIGO is the name of this device, and basically what they do is they have laser light that's shining back and forth between a series of mirrors that are separated by kilometers. And what they have to do is measure the location of these mirrors to an accuracy of an atomic nucleus. Not an atom, but a nucleus. So extraordinary distance measurements are necessary to try and measure gravitational radiation. And they haven't detected anything yet. They're not really expected to detect anything for years, because the coalescence of binary black holes is supposedly a rare phenomena. Okay, so we have direct measurements of the mass of these pulsars, and they come out to be exactly the mass we would expect for a neutron star. Some of them are more massive than 1.4 times the mass of the sun. I think the heaviest one that's been found is about 2 times the mass of the sun. So it's a very consistent story. Questions? Well, when we have these exotic objects, where we have unearthly magnetic fields and spins and masses and densities, we kind of expect exotic phenomena. And one of those is what's called a magnetar. So a typical pulsar has an astronomical magnetic field. A magnetar has an even bigger magnetic field. So you remember when we talked about the sun, we talked about magnetic fields releasing energy to make solar flares. So we have the same sort of possibility here with magnetic fields that are a billion times the magnetic field of the sun. Incredibly huge magnetic fields. And what we see with magnetars started out as a theoretical object, and there are a handful of objects that seem to match the theoretical properties that are expected, in that they produce bursts of very high energy light, like X-rays. And the idea here is that this is caused by magnetic reconnection. And this is in contrast to the X-ray bursters that I was talking about before, where we have binary systems, where a companion is dumping material which is building up enough to get a thermonuclear reaction on the surface of the pulsar. So I promised you that I was going to talk about things that were spinning even faster than the crab. So these are called millisecond pulsars. And they have a spin, I don't think anyone has a spin that's less than a millisecond. So we're talking about, well, we're talking about more like about 2 millisecond rotation rates. And you can imagine that if something is spinning fast enough, it'll break up. So I hate to use the word centrifugal, but the centrifugal force has the possibility of kind of breaking apart something that's spinning too fast. And 2 milliseconds is close to the breakup spin rate for these millisecond pulsars. So the question is how they got going this fast. And the answer is believed to be the same story about binary sorts of situations. So again, in this particular picture, they're talking about a black hole, but this could just as well be a neutron star. If this guy is going to dump material onto it, it's going to form an accretion disk. So the stuff that's going to be hitting the pulsar is going to be already in orbit. So when it hits the pulsar, there's going to be conservation of angular momentum, and it's going to spin that guy up to faster and faster speeds, up to the maximum possible speed that it could have, which would be this breakup speed. So that is what we think is happening with binary pulsars, and there's good evidence that basically for this whole story. We see cases where the remnant is still visible. We see cases where it's being eaten away, and we see cases where it seems to have been totally destroyed by this sort of process. Okay, so exotic object one, pulsars, kind of like neutron stars, which are observed as pulsing radio sources, pulsars, and seems to be consistent with the story that was told in 1934 that you could have an object that has kilometer sort of size and is made out of degenerate neutrons, holding up the object against the force of gravity. Okay. Black holes. So, I'm kind of not sure how to start on this topic. The name black holes was actually invented as a disparaging term, because for the longest time, people didn't think that it was possible to have such an object. So these things were predicted theoretically as a consequence of Einstein's general relativity, something like 1917. And even as late as 1950, people were arguing about whether it could possibly be black holes. And certainly black holes are going to be difficult to detect because, at least approximately speaking, nothing gets out. Right, because the escape velocity is more than the speed of light, so nothing has even the speed of light. So black holes are called black because they should be totally non-radiating. Well, I want to stick with that story, but I'm going to get into trouble because of a guy named Hawking. So Hawking discovered what is kind of a footnote to this story. So it's still true that black holes are going to radiate almost nothing, but it turns out that we have an odd process that can occur very near the Schwarzschild radius. There's no T in Schwarzschild. Right, so this is the no escape. So anything that's going in here, we're never going to know about. But it turns out we can have situations right at this, well, I shouldn't say right at, near that boundary, where we have light that is spontaneously produced by the following sort of situation, where we can have out of nothing, right, created a particle and antiparticle pair. Right, for example, a positron and an electron. And this guy can go down the hole, and this guy can escape, and we can still have conservation of energy. So we started with zero energy. This guy going down the hole is going to be some negative amount of energy. This guy escaping is going to be some positive sort of energy. So by what's called virtual particle production, so this all happens near the Schwarzschild radius, which is also called the event horizon. Event horizon turns out, in some sense, to be a better word, because Schwarzschild only dealt with the case of non-rotating black holes. So there are actually a few other types of black holes, and we actually expect them to be more common. So rotating black holes, they were figured out by Kerr. Electrically charged black holes are another possibility. So all of these other sorts of black holes have slight sort of complications. They all have an event horizon, a place that if you a line that you cross and it's impossible to come back from, and there's no way that you can learn about anything that's happening interior to the event horizon. And it might be worth commenting that we actually think that lots of black holes are spinning very, very, very fast, so that the Schwarzschild solution is not the appropriate one. And you have to use this other one due to Kerr. Okay, so why is this kind of not so important in the end? So it turns out that in terms of light that's produced, the light that's produced is like black body light. But it turns out that the temperature of this light is inversely proportional to the mass of the object. And so if we're talking about something that has a mass of the sun, the equivalent temperature is millions of degrees above absolute zero. And the black body radiation from something that's that cold is something you would never, ever, ever be able to detect. But theoretically, there is some light, Hawking radiation, that is leaving a black hole. The only way you would ever detect it would be with these mini black holes. I think we talked about last time or sometime about the possibility of very, very, very low mass black holes. They would have a very, very, very high temperature. And it turns out you could easily detect those guys if they are around in number. Okay, so I'm probably never going to talk about this again, and I'm going to repeatedly say that nothing gets out. But you have to remember there's this footnote that Hawking radiation actually does get out, but it is infinitesimal unless the black hole is very small. And the black holes we'll be talking about are very big, so the Hawking radiation is totally negligible. Well, so how are we going to detect a black hole if nothing gets out? And so this has always been a black hole, and it always has been radiating. The upshot is that once you go through the event horizon, we can't see anything that's a result. But before you go in the event horizon, you can be heated to high temperature and emit, in particular, stuff like X-rays. So here we have stuff that's being dumped onto this black hole, and there's going to be a little accretion disk. And in that accretion disk, the temperatures can reach millions of degrees, and it can produce X-rays that we can detect. Okay, so that can clue us in that there's something interesting going on in a particular location. But we've seen that neutron stars, through exactly the same sort of pictures, can also produce X-rays. So how do we, and of course, this guy is way too small to see, and our telescopes, we're only going to see this guy. So how can we tell the difference between whether this is a black hole that stuff is producing X-rays when it falls into, or whether this is a neutron star that something is falling into? And the answer is, if this is a binary situation, we can measure the masses. If we determine the mass of this is more than 3 times the mass of the sun, it can't be a neutron star. It's got to be something else. So in famous cases that have been measured, we measure this thing as 10 times the mass of the sun. So we know it's nothing close to a neutron star. I remind you that exactly what the upper mass limit of the neutron star is kind of up for grabs. So if we measured something that was 2 times the mass of the sun, we could not say that it's definitely a black hole, just that it's some sort of collapsed object. Okay, so at this point in time, we've got dozens of objects which are producing X-rays and have to have masses more than 3 times the mass of the sun. And so everyone thinks are black holes, but it's a somewhat indirect measurement. The upshot in a couple of days, well, I guess we're going to have Thanksgiving break in there, a couple of weeks, is going to be these black holes that we're talking about that have a mass that's 3, 4, 5 times the mass of the sun, they're small change. So these days we're measuring the masses of black holes that are in the billions of masses of the sun. So they can't be formed by this process, right? Because the biggest stars we know of are only 100 times the mass of the sun. And we think that a lot of material is being blown off in the supernova process. So this sort of thing, we're not expecting to make black holes that have a mass of more than, say, 20 times the mass of the sun. So we're going to be very interested into figuring out how these billion mass black holes were formed. And they probably formed very early in the universe by special processes, which we'll talk about eventually. Well, I've already used this term relativity to describe the theories that Einstein came up with. And it's important to kind of know your relativities, I guess. So there are two relativities that Einstein came up with. The first one, as you might guess, came first. It's called special relativity. I assume it was only called special relativity after general relativity was discovered. So general relativity is kind of 1915, and special relativity is 1905. And they're radically different theories. There's really no obvious connection between the two theories. So the commonality in name is kind of a problem. So general relativity is a theory to replace Newton's theory of gravity. Special relativity is a theory to replace ideas that go back to the very earliest thoughts about how the world works. And they're often associated with Galileo. But Galilean invariance and so what we're talking about here is how space and time works. So if you go on an airplane, you may have to change your watch because you go through time zones, but you don't think that your watch works any different just because you're going fast. Right? You don't think that your mass or your size change just because you're going fast. So automatically, people have always thought that time was kind of a universal quantity, that there could be aliens 10 light years away from us that have watches that are ticking, and they're ticking. If they're built the same way as ours, they're ticking at exactly the same rate as ours is. It turns out that there are I mean, not only does common sense tell you that that's the way it is, but there are very deep reasons to think that that's the way it is. But that's not the way it is. It turns out that there are kind of two ways the universe could have been created. So on very general principles, it could be the way common sense tells you it works. Meter sticks are meter sticks and watches are watches. And it kind of doesn't matter how fast you're going. Or there could be a speed limit. That as you go faster and faster, as you approach the speed of light, things get substantially different. And you can show on very general principles that there really, this is one of those situations where there really are just those two choices. And we talked briefly about the possibility of these recent experiments that came out of CERN that suggest that something's going, neutrinos in particular, are going faster than the speed of light. And I don't know if I'm willing to bet my life that that's the case, but boy, I'm willing to bet lots of money that that experiment is wrong, that nothing can go faster than the speed of light, because there just aren't easily imaginable ways. You can write down theorems that have very general ifs and very definitive thens, and there sure seem to be just these two possibilities. And Newton and everyone else before 1905 believed in Galilean invariance, that things work in the natural way. And Einstein came up with this other theory that seems to be correct. So what are kind of the consequences of this theory? So one is that moving clocks run slow. And if you're moving at the speed of an airplane, the effect is very, very, very small. It's not noticeable by people. But we have tested it with atomic clocks. You put an atomic clock, a very accurate clock, in an airplane, and you can see that it's running slow compared to the atomic clock that's on the ground. The faster and faster you go, the bigger and bigger the difference between how moving clocks are working and how clocks that are at rest are moving. And the effect becomes arbitrarily large as you get arbitrarily close to the speed of light. Distances along the motion shrink. So this is going to sound kind of funny. If this meter stick were traveling like this, its length would match exactly a meter stick that you're holding in your hands at rest. But if this meter stick were traveling like this, it would look shrunk. And when I say it would look shrunk, it's not just kind of an optical illusion. It is shrunk. Any sort of measurement that you would make would come to the conclusion that it's shorter than it was before. The amount of the shrinking, again, is negligible at airplane sort of speeds, but as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, you get quite noticeable shrinking. So these things have been detected and confirmed at using very accurate apparatus at airplane speeds, but as you get particles, as we can at someplace like CERN, going 99.9999% of the speed of light, you can get huge changes. You can have clocks that are running 10 times or 100 times slower than they run on Earth. So the effects are immediate and obvious. So the only reason these things aren't immediate and obvious to us is we're limited by supersonic speeds. We're never going anywhere close to the speed of light. The other main effect is not talked about in our book, but it's just as important as these other effects, and it's lack of synchronization. I don't know, it's hard for me to convince you that this is important, but I tell you that it is as important as the other effects. And that is that if I very carefully synchronize the clocks at the edge of the table, if somebody is going by at high speed, they won't look synchronized. They'll look like they're out of tune. So the idea of the same time kind of doesn't make sense unless you're not moving relative to your clocks. What a moving guy says is the same time is not what you think is the same time. So these weird phenomena have nothing to do with gravity. They just have to do with the nature of space and time. And that's what Einstein worked out in 1905. But it turns out that if you do that to the nature of space and time, there's no way that Newton could also be right. So as soon as Einstein realized that Galilean invariance was false, and this other stuff, which is usually called Lorentz invariance, incidentally, that's a big clue that that something a little bit is, I think, wrong with people's normal perceptions of this. So the main equations that are involved in Einstein's theory are named for somebody else, Lorentz. So it wasn't that Einstein was alone in these ideas. There were other people who were kind of barking up the same tree. They just didn't nail it the way Einstein did. So for 10 years, what Einstein was doing is trying to write down a theory of gravity that was consistent with the new way of thinking about space and time. And it was an extremely difficult task. He actually hired mathematicians to help him with it. And the answer is, and I guess we'll have to talk about this more next time, because it's kind of a crazy idea, and that is to say that space isn't flat, it's bent. So the amount of bending of space depends on the mass that's present in that space. And because space isn't flat, we see objects that seem to be not going in straight lines that are going in straight lines. So technically speaking, Mercury is going in a straight line. It only seems to be going in a curve because of the bending of space and time. Well, it's pretty incredible.